Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Have you ever wondered why such a thing as a gingered pear and chicken salad served in lime jello exists? What about baked bananas rolled in ham served with cheese sauce? Or anything at all made with Spam or even just Spam itself?
Don't knock Spam. The foods and recipes many of us grew up with were thanks to American corporations and their advertising departments. Not only were the corporations promoting the products they were selling, they were also promoting what it meant to be an American.
Christina Ward's newest book, American Advertising Cookbooks, looks at how things like Jell-O, bananas, and Spam became household staples, and it's a fascinating story. She joins me in the studio now and explains that this book came out of her first one, Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration.
In doing all my research about the history of food preservation, it became really, really clear that food preservation in and of itself was such a cataclysmic event in culinary history. And then when you look, start peeling that back and looking closer, the ability to keep food longer than a few days changed how we're going to eat, because then it enabled just your small farmer to have a few more days, and then he could take it to market. And then those market folks then became processors, as they would make things out of it. And then it just, the business expanded. I mean, if you think about Hellman's mayonnaise was started by Richard Hellman in, I think, 1910. And he owned a small deli in New York City. And he and his wife made their recipe mayonnaise in the back of the shop and sold it out of the shop. And because of the technology of being able to preserve things and then start marketing and the distribution, within 3-4 years, he was nationwide.
And you think, yes, we are a business-oriented culture. Americans are very good about the bootstrap thing and the entrepreneur thing and making stuff to sell. Corporations somehow took over.
They did. And I think that there's a myth that this rise of corporations is, you know, something of a recent of memory. It's not. So even with the example of Hellman's, they started, and by the 1920s, in the span of 10 years, they were bought out by another company that eventually became General Foods. So,
although they kept the name Hellman's.
They did keep the Hellman's as a brand, and that's one of the things that's really interesting is that a lot of the foods that we're familiar with today that we think are just freestanding things are just brand names, and they're owned by a larger corporate entity. And that's started right in the 1910s. This is coming out of the kind of that gilded age of the corporate robber barons. And so there was almost like an American mania for building the biggest company you possibly could. And the laws at the time kind of helped that along. What we think of as like some of the anti-monopoly laws didn't really come in until after the 1920s. And since they were enacted in the 20s, they've been kind of peeled back, you know, a little bit at a time until now, where, again, we're in a position where a lot of what they call holding companies are owning a diversified portfolio of actual companies. So you've got food manufacturers that are also cigarette manufacturers and sellers. And so it's an interesting food landscape.
Well, and as you say, it started 100 years ago, really,
it
in
did,
this country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it seems to me that we have somehow maybe tried to reverse that a little bit in the last decade or so, where, you know, we're interested in going to farmers markets and buying somebody's local preserves, or we're interested in finding out who actually owns the companies that produce the food that we eat.
And I think it's the arc. I'm a fan of pure science, but I'm also cautious about applied science, because sometimes the applied sciences are applied by corporations, and that's the unintended consequences. And I think we have to remember culturally, we're not too far away from actual starvation, where people did starve, where, you know, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from for the next few days, you were really in trouble. And so that ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins and, you know, make it more than what it actually is. When it first started in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it really served a great purpose and helped people. But the unintended consequences, of course, are the increased amounts of salts and sugars that have added to the obesity crisis in the United States. So that helped trigger that kind of the consciousness about, like, what are we really eating here? And do we really want to eat this?
Did it also affect the idea of sort of corporate agriculture, where we have monocrops because we have to support the kind of processing that you're describing here?
Absolutely. That's the story of bananas. Bananas are a monocrop. They are asexual reproducers, which means, like a tuber, like when you're planting tulips, you have to put the thing in the ground to get the thing to fruit. And by doing that with one variety over time through Central America, that decimated the local kind of flora and agriculture systems. Not to mention, because something like a banana, which has really only a few natural predators and doesn't really evolve in its DNA, is very susceptible to things like a root rot or a leaf rot. And so Central America itself has been poisoned over the past 70 years by pesticides. And so, again, it's unintended consequences. We want bananas. We like bananas. But now bananas are actually on the verge of extinction because the predatory viruses and blights that have been evolving to eat those bananas are winning. So right now, and again, this is kind of the interesting thing with the science of bananas, and it's happening, as you said, with a lot of other crops too, is how do we protect from vermin and with pesticides? And so that next phase is now you're seeing a lot of what they call genetically modified, where much of the wheat crop and corn crops and soy crops in the United States are actually modified that have the pesticide adjusted in the actual seed. And so the plant itself is resistant to any type of blight.
So how did we learn to love Spam, which is one of the things you mentioned?
The story of Spam is so interesting. Again, it comes out of food preservation. In 1906, there was a law finally passed called the Food and Drug Act. And it was the first time in the United States that we had any kind of national rules about what actually was food. And it actually published a book called The Formulary, and it defined every kind of food and what was in it, what it could contain. And before that, there were a lot of food scares, contaminated foods and things passed off as food that wasn't. And so the idea of a spam, which is a pork byproduct, mostly fat with a lot of salt, prior to the development in World War I, would have never passed muster with the United States because the consumer was afraid of any kind of adulterated foods. But through really good marketing, which was the idea of saying, this is for the country, this is healthy, it's fortified, it's got vitamins, it's inexpensive, and so you should eat it. You know, you're doing your part for the war efforts by giving it to your friends and family. And so it was also served as a military ration. And so post-World War II then, as many soldiers came home, they developed a taste for that salty, porky fat, which, you know, fry it up. It's kind of delicious in a terrible way. And so the marketing then changed to say, you know, reward your hardworking men with, you know, Spam. And that's really how they taught us to love that taste.
Well, and it sounds like it's both, and I hesitate to use the word collusion because maybe that's too strong a word for it, but between corporations and the government, if it's like for the war effort.
Oh, there's collusion.
Okay, so it's not too strong a word.
Oh, it is not too strong a word at all, because one of the pioneers of food advertising was Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, who's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was trained in the early psychoanalytic techniques and understanding of human psychology. His first job before he went into advertising was working for the Committee for the Public Interest, which was a precursor to the CIA and was in charge of propaganda during World War I and up until the early 1930s. So there's a definite relationship between governments and advertising and corporations. funnily enough, I mean, it comes to his partners he was working with at the CPI were the Dulles brothers, the infamous Dulles brothers, who one headed up the CIA and then one worked for John Kennedy.
And had an airport named after him.
And has an airport named after him. So again, and this also, I think, tells the story, it's a smallness. And I think, you know, part of that, we forget, we think we're a big country, but we find it here in Milwaukee, kind of that joke of small Milwaukee. When you're working in the elite, the corporations, we're looking at some of the early founding families, everybody knew everybody. So it wasn't necessarily a malicious collusion, but it was a friendly collusion of like, this is the guy you went to Harvard with. This is the guy you served in the early propaganda outfit with. And they all helped each other.
Before we turned on the microphones, we were talking about how this is about way more than food. It's about culture and defining culture and what is acceptable and what isn't through the advertising, through the kind of foods that you were told to eat or encouraged to eat. And, you know, it had even involved gender norms.
Absolutely. And this is where I think I wanted to tell this story. Because it was that one time that I could pinpoint in the kind of American history of when we really became Americans. And it was that idea of the communications, printing presses became cheap. The food became cheaper. Travel, railroads opened up the country to the expansion. Immigrants coming in. So we had all these different influences and then people trying to control those outcomes and then having the tools to do it. So when you talk about like the idea of food from our early Puritan founders, they had very distinct ideas about what food was proper. I mean, if you're looking at early Protestant food cookbooks, there's no spices for a number of reasons. And that through line, through those families and through those generations, the traditions held true. So, you know, we're still in the 1930s and 40s and covering everything in white sauce, which is, you know, not a bechamel. It's just flour and a little milk. It's not really, it's more like paste. But the idea is to keep everything packed full of calories because you needed it if you're going to work in a factory or a farm. And keep everybody eating in a very similar way because you didn't want things that would be too exciting or too outside what the norm was. And so that's where you get like the great Born in Milwaukee, the Settlement Cookbook, which was founded by earlier settler German Jews. And as that second wave of Jewish immigration came to Milwaukee, which were mostly Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jews, who had a totally different type of outlook on food and cooking. And, you know, the high-born, very elite German Jews wanted to teach the newcomers, this is how you're American. You cook like us. And that became like a real through line through a lot of the immigrant groups had different settlement houses that were usually funded by the wives of the manufacturer factory owners here in Milwaukee. And they each had a way to help teach the kids, teach everybody, again, how to be American. And being American meant being more Protestant, more conservative, and, you know, less fun, really.
No spices.
No spices.
Yeah. My father grew up in, you know, a Protestant household in Rhode Island. And I remember him telling me that for the longest time, until he went into the service and then met my mother, who was Armenian, completely different, you know, and first generation. His family had been in the country for a few generations. He didn't really know anything beyond salt and pepper. There was really nothing else in the cooking. There was clam bakes. So, you know, you'd get the brine, still salt, mm-hmm. you know, the brine of seafood and that. But there was really nothing else. And he said he had to learn to eat garlic in self-defense when he met my mother. But then, you know, his palate expanded. But it's interesting to think about that because he was born, like both parents were born in the 20s. They're growing up in the 30s. And the 40s. And there's it kind of mirrors what you're talking about in this book.
The past isn't that far. And I think, and that's one of the things, it's not that long ago, really, that these influences that were prevalent and are still present today. So even in my family, my father comes from the great, you know, from a Yankee background, actually, same kind of salt and pepper, potatoes, and, you know, enough.
Salt beef and
yep. Yep, boil it. And that's it. My mother, not so much, but also a product of that later baby boom generation where everything came out of a box, a can, you know, frozen, easy. And so growing up, you kind of get this, like as a kid growing up in the 70s, you know, your palate becomes pretty deadened to actual food. And it's that great rediscovery. And I think this goes back to what you were saying earlier, is there are a lot of folks who maybe are in their 30s, 40s, 50s now, who grew up eating box macaroni and cheese and are supporting and enjoying farmers markets because it's really about a discovery almost of like, that's what spinach tastes like. You're not, you know, frozen, defrosted, and then covered in milk or cream, you know. But yeah, so I think that that leads a lot to where we're, what, how we're eating today. We have that memory of blandness and we have a memory of things out of boxes.
But that's part of what this whole effort was about, was to homogenize it.
Absolutely. Because it made us more, again, more American, because then it didn't matter where your folks came from or where your grandparents came from, is you were all American. It was the great equalizer. And we needed that culturally as we talk about immigrant cultures coming in. And even today, this is such a relevant thing because it's that always that push and pull is who's an American, who's not, who gets to decide who an American is, what is being American. I think that if you look at some of the food marketers of the 1940s, say like an Edward Bernays, and if you would tell him that, you know, tacos are of an American food, which fundamentally they are at this point, he would be flabbergasted because that would not have been in his experience or imagination. And so I think that's critical to think about is how we as Americans, we're changing all the time and our definition of who we are changes. And I think we need to also be cognizant of our history of where we didn't do it so well, where we pushed back against some of the new ideas in the immigrant cultures. And we need to be kind of more open-minded to say our true story about being an American is that, you know, everybody who says you're an American is an American.
Where do you see this kind of influence happening now? Do we have the same sort of need to look to corporations to tell us how to eat like an American?
I think we're more savvy to advertisers, but we're not immune. I think where you see a lot of it more is with cooking shows and, you know, this is just a theory because of how we, you know, ate a lot of boxed canned foods growing up for a certain period of time, is that a lot of our food marketing is aspirational. And so what you'll see a lot of is the food, the kits, I think, are really an interesting phenomenon. So when you see those pre-made food kits, or you can order online, or they have delivered, it's essentially buying food in a box. The same thing it was, you know, 50 years ago. But they've kind of zhuzhed up the marketing and you see happy people with their families and the time. And it has this really wonderful aspirational aspect to it. And I think that's where the marketing is going right now. And I think we should also be cautious of it because the negative connotations, again, are describing who gets to be an American. So you see these like beautiful thin people making their dinners and they're all in these very upper middle class houses. And so we have to be really careful again about the messages of class and gender and, you know, how we judge people who are eating what kind of food.
Well, and those meal kits that you're talking about, the food may come in a box, but it aspires to be fresh.
Exactly. There's still some level of preservation and artificiality going on with those.
Has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. How is it going to come to your house in a box and not be rotten?
Right. And fundamentally, it's still, you know, I find it really interesting because just like the reading the box of macaroni and cheese where it's like, you know, boil noodles, add the things, those meal kits with that idea of aspirational freshness are still like you follow just the instructions. Don't you're not actually cooking. You're just following instructions. And that is, I think, one of the consequences of this time period in advertising cooking, it kind of took away the ability to cook. There's a whole multiple generations of folks who don't really know how to cook things anymore. I'm pro bringing back some home economics education for kids.
I completely agree. And in Europe, they still do.
Oh.
And it's both genders. It's not assumed that it's just girls.
What's interesting when you say Europe, too, is the Europeans, of course, there's processed food in Europe, but there's less effect, overall effect, than here in the United States. The corporate hold on the American food systems was so pervasive throughout the entire food system, say from like the 20s through the 70s, even now, that it was able to really shape, again, how we eat overall, and less so in Europe. So again, they're still fighting some of the obesity crisis that come from processed foods, but not to the extent that we are here in the United States.
It's true. I mean, for example, when I was in Germany, I heard a lot from my German colleagues about how Americans have ammonia chicken and they don't want it. They won't eat it. Because it's processed with ammonia to probably kill whatever it's going to, you know.
Extends and, the life.
Yeah, and they just will not have it.
And I think, and that's where more Americans need to, and again, there's so many different influences to find that balance. If you're going to Outpost to buy pure natural chicken or to Whole Foods, you're charged a premium for that. And so in the United States, freshness is at an expense. So if you're not in a financial position to spend, you know, X amount per week on your food budgets, your choices are quite limited. And again, that's a product of the American corporations, that they can pull the nutrient levels down, they can mass package things, and you can get the caloric intake up and the nutrient levels just about barely acceptable and make it cheap enough that poor people can eat it.
Right. That's, and I was going to say, there's the word cheap enough.
Right.
Because if nothing, you know, we look for bargains in this country. That's a cultural thing, is that we all want a bargain.
We do want a bargain. And I think, and that's a great disconnect. And you and I were talking earlier. I think the difference, and that's, you know, part of what an American is seeing the cost without seeing the value. And so I think we need to find more value and worry about cost a little differently.
Well, Christina Ward, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Milwaukee author Christina Ward's newest book is American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O.
Ward will be at Boswell Bookstore tonight, where she says she'll have with her a chocolate cake made from one of the recipes in the book. Fair warning, it contains sauerkraut, and it's topped with mayonnaise frosting. She swears it tastes much better than it sounds.
It would have to.